what are we going to talk about?
Cape York, a bit of my own studies mixed in into the mix with some of the information that Wilderness Society has sent me, and it's very important. So please take some time to listen, and I hope you enjoy the dynamics of far northern Queensland. Cape York, one of the last great wild places on earth. Cape York, far northern Queensland. Hi, I'm Ian Brown, also known at Nimbin Radio as Shamrock. Having spent many a heat rash filled day in Darwin and the surrounding tropical savanna and glorious monsoon rainforest ecosystems, studying, playing, rejoicing in Australia's extreme diversity, I can only lick my lips at the thought of indulging in a journey through Cape York's sparse tropical landscapes. From its sparkling snow-like sand dunes to its tropical, almost equatorial-type rainforests and wetlands, reminiscent of nearby Papua New Guinea with its shared flora and fauna species. Yes, sheer paradise indeed, but not for the faint-hearted. Suffocating tropical heat, sinister fiery storms, and crocs the size of a pair of the surfing king of Tonga's longboards. Cape York, why haven't I been then? I've journeyed right round this dreamtime nation. Well, I did plan to travel the length of Cape York from Cairns in the south to the tip of Australia with a mechanic mate of mine during the Queensland dry season of 99 when I was living back in old Sydney town. My friend used his cash to race his motorbike and a lovely German lady sent me wheeling offshore, literally, for a spell. I had fallen in love with the thought of copying the Bush Tucker man's, that's Les Hiddens, mini voyages through Cape York, where on one of his earlier journeys, as a young fella, Les conquered much of the trail on foot. Phew! And then, of course, there are Kennedy's historic misfortunes in the steamy north, droving cattle through chokingly thick jungle. Oh dear. My German lover found me mad, I'm sure, when I compared this slice of heat-stroked paradise to Africa in explorational excitement. Nonetheless, I never made it to Cape York, only to Cape Tribulation back in 96 to the Daintree Rainforest. A good cause. Yes, the Wilderness Society has sent me the following important information. Cape York, two-thirds the size of the state of Victoria, and one of three most unspoiled wilderness areas left on Earth. With less than 1% of having so far been cleared, there is far less human hindrance to animal pathway movements between the mountains to the ocean as compared to the southern Australian regions. The rare golden-shouldered parrot, cassowaries, palm cockatoos and Australia's only cuscus are to be found here. Now I'll intervene for a moment with some food for thought. Keep in mind that Papua New Guinea is joined to Australia, as the Torres Strait Islands to the north of Cape York are but drowned mountaintops, much like the Whitsunday Islands of central Queensland. And during the Ice Age periods, as in the Pleistocene, Australia and Papua New Guinea are as one, as ocean's levels recede to be stored as ice in higher latitudes. I know from my own past studies that Cape York's important wetland habitats function in collaboration with the monsoon wetlands of not only Northern Territory, Kakadu for example, but also Papua New Guinea's, and in relation to my favourite topic, the Southeast Asian and Australian monsoon system, which varies annually in duration and intensity between the three regional wetland locations. So each of the wetland regions are very important in harbouring moving and migrating birds such as Brolga, Saurus cranes, Jabiru and the ancient magpie geese. I'd like to add also that there are no foxes in the tropical top end. The European fox so far is mostly sticking to its more temperate climate origins in Australia. Thus, there is no fox predation on marsupial species such as the northern quoll and northern brown bandicoot. However, there has been a shift in fire regime due to the changing cultural land use practices in the tropical top end savannas, both in the Northern Territory and in Queensland. And these now hotter fires are impacting greatly upon quoll and bandicoot habitats, modifying their environment and corrupting the two species' adaptations to these fire-manipulated landscapes, which were once devoid of less fuel loads, particularly with the indigenous folks' fire stick maintenance of the savanna, mosaic burning in the cooler, earlier dry season, and allowing for more variation in the habitat for terrestrial mammals and birds such as goulding finches. This also with the introduced African paragrass, which also increases fire intensity in the tropical savanna, and depletes and places pressure on the life history traits and survival strategies of savanna dominants such as Eucalyptus tetradonta and Eucalyptus miniata.
Okay, well, just at that point, Ian, thank you very much. This is, what, a part of your doctoral thesis or something, is it?
No, just a passion of mine. I do ecological research in my own time. I do mostly Indigenous education at Lismore. I'm doing a dip ed.
Yeah.
But, while I'm doing the dip ed, I write thesis. I've got the one about the crocodiles of global warming that's been well received. ABC have agreed with my findings. I'd love the environment. If I can help out and send a message out around the world, I will. And we've got more coming up. You might have guessed that I have a passion for the top end, but it seems our friends at the Wilderness Society do too. Please take heed. They explain that resources abound in Cape York and there are plans for a massive new bauxite mine near the West Coast wetlands and a pipeline through central Cape York. Inaction is the real threat here. Both feral animals and domesticated cattle are degrading national parks unchecked. Weeds, and here it is again, fire, left to burn uncontrollably, are changing landscapes. Scientists believe waves of extinctions will occur, sweeping in amongst the small mammals to grass, seed-eating bird species. And another very important matter, let's not forget about the Indigenous folk of Cape York. They have been caretakers and environmental lovers for many thousands of years. Their knowledge and skills crucial to the long-term management and protection of these precious ecosystems, as the Wilderness Society proudly state. And I hope you will all agree with me that this can be fostered by all parties, acknowledging and spiritually investing in a need for the nurturing of Aboriginal culture, and in Aboriginal terms, in Cape York. A new vision, states the Wilderness Society. Controlled development under the banner of state and federal government protection commitment. Oh yeah. Indigenous protected areas, national parks and nature refuges, along with the Wild River Declarations, essential for the protection of wetland, river corridors and natural water flows. These are all on the Wilderness Society's wish list. Hooray! How then do they propose to do all this? Well, funding, of course, to prevent species extinctions and provide job support for local Cape Yorkians. Ecotourism, native produce, art and cultural exchange included. Sustainable farming and economic ventures to aid in nature conservation principles. Also, and of course on the front line, World Heritage listing, as Cape York is indeed an outstanding global significant area. As an ecologist of sorts myself, forever willing to learn and love, I feel it a worthy cause to at least share this with you important Nimbinites and podcastees. It has stirred something in you, has it? Please, beckon literature and learn about our diverse Australian landscapes. Get involved. Help! Yeah, it's hard to beat our subtropical mountain and volcanic enriched valley lifestyle here. I live here too. But our sticky northlands are also endlessly intriguing and important for many reasons. Let's not forget that the Barrier Reef runs parallel to Cape York also. We could do a whole segment on the horrible impacts due to the unscrupulous development in Cape York on the world's largest coral reef as well. Cape York has 3,000 plant species, half of Australia's bird species, one third of our mammal species and one quarter of our frog and reptile species. So, www.wilderness.org.au.
Well, there we go. How do you do? Well, congratulations, Ian. You put a lot of work into that. How long did you spend out there tramping around?
My studies, I did my studies in ecology in Darwin.
Yeah.
So I spent a lot of time in the savannas and rainforests of Darwin, but I've only got as far, only went as far as Cape York, up to Cape York, as far as Cape Tribulation, but I've been researching that part of the world as well as Papua New Guinea and the Top End and the Kimberley area. That's a passion of mine. And also I work here within subtropical rainforest management, so anywhere from Sydney up, I've worked hard at understanding how these ecosystems function and if I can share the blessings of these areas and get people to, you know, put in, and it all comes with knowledge. I mean, there's a lot of books out there, and a lot of people listening right now will probably know as much, if not more, than I do, of course. You know, we all know something about these ecosystems, but I'm just saying there's a lot of good material out there where you can pick up a Bush Tucker Man video and learn, you know. Yeah. There's some beautiful videos through ABC shops and all the rest. Even go to the Lock Council Library and pick up the Big Wet. They correspond to northern Queensland because they're the same latitudes. And those wetlands, again, they all collaborate with New Guinea, Darwin and Queensland, simply because the monsoon doesn't always have the same frequency and duration in these areas. It varies from year to year. So one area might have a good rainfall, and in North Queensland it might not. So you need to swap around these areas and let these areas incubate.
Yeah, you mean you can't just jump to conclusions on what you've seen. Things change from year to year.
Yeah, you knock out one wetland, and you've only got the ones in Northern Territory, and they need to run.
Oh, yes, I see what you mean. Mm. Yeah, with a variable climate, one wetland can compensate for it.
That's right. That's right. With the movements of magpie, geese, and all the crane and stork species, let alone the smaller duck species like whistling ducks. There's a multitude of animal species that need these wetlands.
Yeah,
that's just one ecosystem.
How did you get around there, Ian, up there where there's no roads?
My studies have been through Charles Darwin University, so we've had no problem getting out to places. We did back-burning fires in the savannah, doing carbon ratio testing.
And then walking through the blackness afterwards?
Yeah, well, we're burning 50% plots at a time. So, but the problem is the whole bloody thing burnt down. We lost the reef.
That is the thing with fires, isn't
it? Yeah, but the fires up there aren't as hot as down here with the bigger fuel loads down here, because the forest is so much thicker. There you've got savanna grassland, woodland. But these introduced species, such as the paragrass from Africa, they're affecting the savanna dominance up there, burning them out. Well, yes, savanna dominance, you've got eucalyptus species such as Tetradonna and Miniata. They're the two. There's
and
a
mod. What are they are common names for those?
Eucalyptus, gum trees up there.
Yeah.
And
what? Short, not as big as the ones.
No, they're huge. Some of them are well over 100 feet tall, but they survive off lignotuber. So they will burn and resprout.
Lignotuber.
Well, such a harsh climate up there with a long dry season, they need to store energy, and they will send tap roots down through the soil profile, so they can still function as a canopy dominance through the dry season by collecting water.
So it's like a tuber or something.
It's you can almost say it's like a big onion, but in a way it's not really. But that's a bad, poor analogy, really. But it's an area where there's so much carbon energy that if a fire burns the majority of one of the trees and almost kills it, it will reshoot from the energy from the bottom of the tree and regrow again. They use seed as well. Black cockatoos will crush so much seed. The red-tailed black cockatoo.
Yeah, which we get here.
They're beautiful. The praff, the Larrakeen word, praff, in Darwin. But they will use seed as well.
Have you heard the story about them, just by the way, the black cockatoos? You heard the legend?
No.
The saying, black, when you see a swarm of black cockatoos, it means rain's coming. Have you heard that one?
No, I like that.
I think the reason it happens is the black cockatoos fly very high. They're the very high flying, so they get a lift on low pressure cells coming in, which herald rain, you see. So when you see black cockatoos, it's like a dolphin swimming in front of the ship, you know. They're just getting a lift, but then behind them comes the ship of the storm.
I quite like when there's low pressure around, barometric pressure, that swallows fly lower to the ground. Everything's lower to the ground.
And as it's coming, you can see them jumping up, darting, and getting those insects that
That's
the exciting time when that storm comes, especially a tropical storm.
Well, that's what sends me between this part of the world and the top end. It's simply because Darwin has the highest cloud-to-ground lightning discharge areas on Earth, out the back of Darwin at places like Fog Dam. Lightning strikes
in other words,
cloud
the biggest lightning in the world, is that?
Yeah, it's the world's hotspot for thunderstorms is it's Kakadu and Darwin region.
Oh, so yeah.
There's 90 a year in Darwin on average. There's a place in Florida has across the sky lightning is the highest in Florida.
Florida.
But Darwin, I mean, has been so much closer to the equator. I mean, you have the escarpment, which latent heat rises off the escarpment in the build-up season with heat troughs.
Yeah.
That's in our springtime down here. And then you have the moist air coming in as the monsoon, the sun's coming out of the
and
equator.
That's like a conductor or something.
That's it. And then you've got bauxite up there and all the rest of it. So
which is
fully
from aluminium,
conductive, yeah.
Which is very conductive, yes.
Oh, the place is just, it's the world's thunderstorm capital. And I storm chase up there. I just get so excited in the monsoon.
Do you take photos?
No, not really. Film storms with video.
Yeah. That would be good.
It's exciting to relive them, but I saw one storm I've written about it in some of my stories about called Godzilla versus the Arnhem Land Plateau from Ubia, and I'll never forget that storm, watching fires sprouting up in the savannah and the magpie geese flying out, and then almost being killed by the storm as it came in.
But you get so much rain first, do you, from the storm, or just a little lightning?
When it comes in, it was like a miniature tornado, actually.
Yeah. So do you get rain with it, or it's just lightning?
Yep, that was right on the... That's when the monsoon hit, and a week later at Owen Pelly in Arnhem Land, a cyclone hit.
And then you get the fires straight up due to the...
In that time of the year, that's the start of the wet season, so the fires aren't a problem. It's the fires being a problem is late dry season, which is September, and because there's in Kakadu, an indigenous folk will do mosaic burning, and that's fantastic, you know.
Yeah.
In other areas where there's farmers and whatnot, and the cultural land practices have been changed, where it could be mining groups or whatever. They're not allowing indigenous groups to mosaic burn, therefore there's more fuel loads burning up through early dry season, which is May, June, July, and then in August, September and start of October, before the build-up starts, it's very hot and still dry, very humid, but starting to get humid, but there's no rain at that point in time, and the fuel loads go berserk, so the whole landscapes are burning, and that's well, Cape York too, you've got to remember.
Yeah. What sets them off?
Lightning strikes, lightning, early dry season,
Their
dry storms will come through.
You
very
get lightning
rain.
All the year through.
No, your dry season's about 4 or 5 months where it's very nice. It's a bit like this time. The weather yesterday is exactly like dry season in Darwin.
Oh, yeah.
Very easy on the system.
Yeah,
hot,
right,
but easy on the system. The rest of the year, 9 months of the year, Darwin has one of the highest relative humidities in the world. It's people from Singapore complain about Darwin's humidity.
All right. Well, you have been listening to all about Cape York Peninsula and assorted brain thoughts stemming from there. Now, time for an ad. The Rainbow Power Company is a specialised manufacturer, distributor and installer of renewable energy equipment. Anything from wind turbines to composting toilets. The company's experienced workforce and their commitment to innovation and education makes the Rainbow Power Company a leader in today's competitive energy market and one of the largest distributors of solar panels and batteries in the country. The Rainbow Power Company, a MIMFM sponsor. Like your topic was very interesting in it. And one thing that did
strike,
yes, well, it got some of my brain cells snapping, and one of the things I was thinking about lightning.
Oh,
and you were mentioning
it.
I've got something to contribute here too. You were mentioning about Darwin being one of the lightning capitals of the world, but there's another place where in Colorado where You might remember Tesla. He realized that he did the calculations and he realized how much electricity was in these lightning bolts. And he worked out that if you could capture one bolt of lightning, there'd be enough electricity in it to power up New York for 3 months.
I think it's 7 or 8 times hotter than the sun. It could be even as high as 10 times. I can't quite remember. But the Americans have been up in Darwin for a long time trying to harness electricity off out the back of Darwin. Darwin's Meteorological Centre is one of the most important meteorological centres in the world, with especially satellite installations for tropical weather research.
Well, that's interesting, because Tesla did finally get his device for capturing lightning working in America in the early days, and well, he had some experiments, some of which did not work, and as a consequence, they pulled down his apparatus. But it was he was well on the way to harnessing lightning.
Yeah.
And the way he planned to do it was that in Colorado, where he went, where the conditions there are, it's very dry, but there's a lot of granite around. Granite also has a high capacitance. There's a lot of electrons stored in granite. So his idea was he'd set up on the mountains in Colorado. It's very dry, but the clouds come over.
They get a lot of humidity coming up from the Gulf, though, from the tropics and subtropics, and that moved through, particularly through the prairies where we get the tornado action, simply because you get the drafts coming up from the Colorado, the Rockies, and then you'll get this humidity coming up from the Gulf, and it's almost like a vacuum. It comes right through, and then it forms thunderstorms, tornadoes.
Tornadoes, a very exciting thing, because there are a lot of negative ions around. And I remember there was one story with Disney in Disney. You know, they call the wind Mariah. That was set in the Colorado mountains.
Well, that is like you said, that those areas in Colorado are very highly, big electrical areas too, conductive. I've seen shows on that as well.
Yeah. Well, anyway, getting back to Tesla, his idea was he'd, on top of one of the high mountains, he'd set up a big bulb, and of course, the lightning strikes the highest point.
Yeah.
And it would strike that pole, and there's pictures of this thing, and then the lightning then would go down and he would store it in the mountain itself.
Is that right?
Because the granite has, like, originally in electrical developments, they thought they could use a capacitor as a battery, because it stores a small amount of electricity, but they found as they went up, well, it wasn't efficient, and then they invented batteries. But Tesla realised, but then if you keep on going, then you get to the stage, the whole mountain becomes like a capacitor. So you can store all this static electricity and then pull a switch and release it.
Yeah.
And you're dealing with mega, mega voltage there. So that you have to get everything right.
Yeah.
Tesla, as good as he was.
How do people work these things out?
Well, that's what he did. And when he invented AC current, and of course, when you invent AC current, then nothing runs on AC. So he had to invent all these...
Angus Young.
What?
Angus Young, AC/DC.
Oh, yes, that's right.
The AC side of it.
That's right. He was the AC side of it. And Edison was the DC.
As a nation, Australia, we're riding on the back of the golden nuggeted fleet. Yep, it used to be sheep, almost a fish, but they don't look the same. But mining revenue accounts for a third of our tax alongside arms sales, believe it or not, little Australia. My friend Chris just told me over at the Oasis that he and his partner and the kids spent time up in Cooktown, and he explained how the right wingers, that's the Nationals especially, have been crying out for 20 years or so now for the sealing of the Cape York Road. The Labor says that this will only occur if bucket loads of money fall from the sky, and if Weeper mine site increases in capacity by threefold to allow for tax revenue for sealing of the road. It sounds inevitable to me. It's going to happen anyway. They're going to steal that road. They're going to bring in this bauxite mine and all these other little intricate ways of degrading the landscape. Oh, yeah, we need money. We need money to run our hospitals. We know, but we don't need money for mining to put back in the bloody arms sales, do we? That's what really annoys me.
Yeah. Well, look, I'm just... this current government and their direction, economic direction, military direction, just...
But that's by state and federal, of course, at the moment. Pretty horrible.
Well, this privatisation thing is definitely both state and private, state and federal.
Yeah.
I don't know about the states going for the war in Iraq so much.
I did research in Darwin, both at university. I also paid research on mine site spoil and growing seedlings, both chemical and physical analysis of soil profiles. For the, we're actually doing it as a conservation.
What do you mean in regeneration? In
regenerating mine site, yeah. Environmental impact assessment and then regenerating mine sites. It's quite interesting.
About it.
It's raping the land, though. There's no doubt about it. But the thing is, you've got...
unraping the land, is it?
At the end of the day, well, the research I was happy to join in on was simply because we're using mine site spoil and using a control with river sand and then coconut mixes with quartzite, quartz and granite. Now, this was to protect the rivers up and down, the riverbeds, because like down in Hawkesbury region in Sydney, they just raped all the riverbeds out and used all the gravel stone for sand mix in nurseries. In Darwin, we're trying to do research on mine site spoils, so we can use the spoil in the nursery trade rather than ripping out the riverbeds around Darwin. So it was a good cause. I, myself, am not big on mining, even though I've studied it.
Yeah.
I think Arnhem Land was horrible.
Yeah, is it possible to regenerate a mine site afterwards?
It's never going to be as good. In time, yes, maybe, but you have degraded the land. You've moved in, you've regrown areas, and if you do it right, you can put in beautiful habitats, say, for goody and finch. We were looking at red salmon gums, which are absolutely exquisite. Eucalyptus up in, I think it's eucalyptus up in Darwin. It's definitely a gum tree. Yeah, it's eucalyptus, that's right. And... you can do some beautiful things, yeah, but again, you're toying with nature. It's not natural. You can put in a reasonably natural system back in, but you've got to keep your weeds out, and you've got to make sure your predators don't damage the area. Luckily, like I said before, there's no foxes, but cane toads have moved into these areas now, and species like carnivorous marsupials, like quolls, are actually feeding on the cane toads, and therefore, you know, they're dropping out of the key system. What upsets me is what happened up near Gove was at Gove was a lot of the elders many years ago all got together and they said we don't want mines in Arnhem Land, and it breaks my heart because that bought the grog, and they knew that they got together and said we don't want white filled mines here. And of course with the mines and with the white treachery of food, we bought flour and sugar and changed Yungu diet. And a lot of the people were getting mental health disease simply because of the change in diet.
Mental health disease?
Yes, you eat flour and water,
yeah.
You're not getting nutrients, proper protein, and you're not getting your iron levels. Your brain doesn't function adequately, so therefore you have mental issues. John Court, that's psychiatrist now, wrote a good book.
What's happened to the bush tucker in the meantime? Well,
well, they change your cultural practices, because if you can just go and see the church or the local mining industry and buy flour and water and make some bread, or you get bread given to you and you get a bit of sugar with it, I mean, that stops you going out and hunting as much. And when younger people and all tribes everywhere in the world cook with fire and eat their food, they're eating with sand and charcoal, so therefore they're cleaning their teeth and making their teeth strong. So just things like tooth decay were coming into place with sugar.
Well, all of this from mining. And I'll tell you another thing about the mining too, it's just the holes they leave too. I did see a program on Four Corners many years ago now, actually, about the uranium mines. After the uranium is finished, well, they just have left, and there's great big holes in the ground.
Yep.
And of course there's contracts to put in place to say that they should regenerate the land, but when they're finished, well, they just say, oh, sorry, we're bankrupt now, the mine's run out, there's no more money, and sue us if you want to, but we've got no money.
Bankrupt. They're going to be bankrupt. The whole system goes in the federal government. They should be copying.
No, they work the mine until it's finished, and then it's finished, and it's time to repair it, and all the money's gone to, you know, shareholders or...
I just think it's hypocrisy, the whole thing. That's what I was getting at, you know.
Yeah.
It should be competent. That should be a safety net. There should be a budgetary safety net simply from the start with proper planning. I think that's just laziness. They just want to spend the money to make the next mine.
Yeah, well, I think before they move on to another mine, they should fix the mines up. And if the mining industry as a whole, the mining industry as a whole should take responsibility for those renegade mines that just dig and close.
Well, Johnny Chai, you know, he's big on pushing the, what's happening at Lake Cow. He's very concerned about the acid getting shipped out there, because they use.
Now, tell us about Lake Cow.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not the one to talk about that. Johnny Chai is the man.
Right.
He'll talk.
Well, you know more about it than me.
I know very little about Lake Cow. Mine's more the top part. I study more in subtropical rainforest while I'm living in this area. He's great with it. He was worried about them shipping out, I think, acid and whatnot. See, to leach, you leach your product. If you're going to go for gold, you've got to remove the soil and rock around the gold,
which is
encasing it, so therefore you use acid
to leach
it out.
And the most deadly acid that you can invent, because gold, that's the reason it exists in free form, because it doesn't get dissolved by anything else.
Well, that's where what I was studying in Darwin as part of my major in tropical ecology and wildlife management was regrowing soil profiles, plants on soil profiles with high acidic nature.
Yeah, well, they use cyanide as their acid, don't they?
Yeah, and then you've got
cyanide.
Yeah, it's cyanide, and then you've got these pools down level, you know, down in the landscape. Muttering away here, where you know you can have runoff and leaching of water coming down through the soil profile. And that's going to land up in rivers. So you've got to have these little safety pools where it collects this acidic waste as it runs through the soil profile. And I suppose, although I don't know that part of it, I suppose they pump it back out into trucks. Where do they take it then?
They reuse it. I think that's what they say. But then when the mine's finished, what do they do with it?
Well, I can tell you one thing. A friend of mine up in Darwin, you might have heard of Mark Bolling. He used to be the journalist Indonesian journalist for the Foreign Correspondent. He now manages ABC in Darwin. Now, when he was working there as a journalist coming back from Indonesia, he grabbed a hippie chick friend of mine from Nimbin, from Charles Darwin Uni, and she broke a story to Mark Bolling, and he went out and they did a beautiful story on the Goulding finches out the back of Darwin. Now, what happened then is some group dumped cyanide on the side of the road on Stuart Highway, and all these Goulding finches, which are coming back.
What group dumped?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure. They got in trouble.
What, a rogue mining company?
I think it was to do with the mines,
Mafia.
But they got caught out. Story went Australia-wide, and they got pulled out for a fine. But they just dumped it on the side of the road in the pool, and all these dead Goulding finches feeding from it, drinking from it. Cyanide. Horrible.
Okay. Now, with that, it's time for some more. In his most agonizing period of his life on the cross. And Palm Sunday is a day that we remember people who have been tortured. And, well, we don't, in Australia, we're not having such a good track record recently ourselves. So there have been a lot of demonstrations down at the Villawood Detention Centre, where they've had big action down there.
Asbestos Centre?
Yes. they've discovered asbestos in Villawood Detention Centre.
And they're going to move them to another place with asbestos in the ground.
Oh, they were going to move them to Baxter, Baxter Nay Woomera, which is not a very pleasant place to go.
Right.
Even Villawood ain't much chop either, but Baxter's even worse. So I'm glad people are protesting down there. This country does not have, will regret, I think, in future, how we have treated refugees who have come here. It's just unfair what we've done to them. And as we heard there, America has got their own problems too, Dave. They're not Yeah, what is this fear? This fear. Americans trying to build a wall across America,
yeah.
From on the Mexican border.
Yeah.
Can you believe that?
Good. Great Wall of New Mexico.
Yeah, to keep the Hispanics out.
Can we say a big hello to our,
yes,
Canadian friends and environmental
also
lovers
over there who haven't? Maybe they'll be building a wall to
keep the Canadians
out too.
No, I think the Canadians would be But look, we know you're environmental lovers, people listening on the podcast.
We fall
in love with Nimbin, and we thank you. And if you want to share stuff back to us about your neck of the woods, please do.
Yeah. So we will be putting this up as a podcast, and like a lot of the stuff, you can go back to and check it up.
Great.
So we also say hello to all the Canadians listening out there. And there are quite a few Canadians in Nimbin itself, did you?
Yep, and also at the university, they've come out to study education. Yeah, they're great.
Palm Sunday today, so don't go torturing anybody.
We've got loads of palm species in this part of the world. Bangalow palm.
Let's talk about palms.
Yes.
Bangalow palms, we all know
the market's
one
on now, and also across the road near the hardware store, there's loads of palms for sale at the moment. Of course, our native ones being the Bangalow palm and Liverstoner, which is the cabbage palm. Then you've got your walking stick palms.
Yes.
So, of course...
Do you know what walking stick palms are very famous for?
No.
Making walking sticks. That's where they get their name.
They're beautiful. And the red seeds especially. And they're a smaller palm. And then you've got, of course, your lawyer palm, which hits your top pocket wallet.
That's a palm.
Grabs in your hair. Yeah.
Lawyer vine.
It's a vine. Yeah, it's a palm. It's a
rattan palm.
Yeah. And up in North Queensland, the thorns are huge, like rosebuds. And cassowaries, for anyone listening who doesn't know what a cassowary is, an endangered species in between New Guinea and Australia. It's our second largest flightless bird. It's a rat.
Yeah, I know what it's like. Emu with a helmet.
With a hump on its head, yeah. And they adapt beautiful blues and red necks, amazing colour. They've adapted to running through lawyer palm in the tropics as fast as a man can sprint. And you couldn't even walk up to one of those vines.
They just leg it through it. Track. Do they eventually grow up on a stalk so they get out of your way?
The lawyer palm. Oh, they just drift around. I mean, the funny thing is that they're like the Day of the Triffids. You walk through the rainforest and you'll see one waving in the breeze like it's waiting like a leech. And then they get in your hair. I used to have really long hair and just, I used to just grab my hair, man. I like them. I reckon they're cool, but they cut your neck up.
All right. What other palms are around here? Come on.
Well, you've got your cycads too, which are an ancient Zamia palm. Yeah, they're not a palm. They're more related. They're in between ferns and palms.
Yeah.
The four main types in this part of the world. You get up towards the central Queensland, up towards the tropics, then your species are doubling. And then if you go offshore to small islands like Fiji and places like that, it's the same as Madagascar has more species of palms than Africa, and it's the same as off the Pacific Islands. Some of these islands off the Pacific Islands have more species of palms than Australia.
Funny. Well, we're really a eucalyptus place rather than palms.
Sclerophyll, Well, because of our poor soils and also the fire regimes, the rainforests are in, obviously sheltered, moist areas,
Yeah, speaking of palms and looking at things, I know Walt Davies, who has been a tireless land carer thing, has developed some walking tours. You know Walt Davies?
I've heard the name.
Yeah. Well, there's some walking tracks and walking trails, and
and bike ones. You can do them bike too. They're doing clubs
now.
I
don't know if we have a bike one yet. Well, we might raise it to Walt sometime for a longer one. Yeah.
Fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah, but there are some. There's a walkers club, and I think you can join. And there's various trips through the. Around the place, finishing at the rocks.
Nimbin Rocks.
Yeah, with the Aboriginal community out there.
Great, great.
Sort of come on board there.
This area has the world's largest tracts of subtropical rainforest. The cauldron, the big Mount Warning volcano, Wollumbin.
Yeah. Has the biggest what?
Well, this area is over the border between Queensland and New South Wales. It's the largest tracts of subtropical rainforest left on the planet. So we're very, it's World Heritage around here, parts of it.
Yeah.
We're very lucky. Our mountains are only up to about 4,000 feet, just over 4,000 feet.
Yeah.
They're not as high as the Rockies or even down in the Australian Alps for that matter. But they're high enough and there's loads of biodiversity. We've got more species of birds on the border here than the Daintree or Kakadu. We're very privileged to be living here.
Well, hush my mouth. Yeah, look, I can believe it too. I know there were so many different kinds of what are them butcher birds?
Eyed and grey.
They're
type of shrike, and they will put their, as shrikes do, or capture their prey, and some of them will put them in like a lard, like a butcher, and jam them up between twigs or onto thorns. Our butcher birds are quite cheeky. They'll come around and eat scraps.
I
love butcher birds. They've got a beautiful call. They're a bit like an Australian magpie, really.
Yes, they are, aren't they? And look, now that we've moved on to birds, there's a thing about when I lived on the mountain too, there are, up here we have our own special kind of lyrebird.
Yep.
Albert's lyrebird.
Very rare.
And it lives in the lawyer vine like you would.
Does it?
Yes, it loves it in there.
Wow.
Because you can see why. It's very, you know, like...
Yep. Protective, yeah.
Very protective, yeah.
And we do get foxes in this part of the world. They don't like rainforests that much. They will hang around the outskirts more. But because our rainforests are smaller and smaller now, they just move through and hunt and prey.
Yeah, well...
And so that'd be on the hit list.
Well, I've got a story on the lyrebird. When I was living on the mountain, there was one bloke who was even almost a hermit. But when you're in a hermit, that's the only time you can study these animals, or birds in this case. And they noticed a particular lyrebird. And the way it works is lyrebirds, the male lyrebird not only has that display at the back.
It's like a peacock.
Yeah, but it's also a very good mimic. And
it's the world's best.
But more than that, see, I'll tell you the way it works, see. The female lyrebird... There's different kinds of male lyrebirds. See, the young juvenile lyrebird wouldn't know many things to mimic, you see.
Cognitive development skills haven't improved.
Well, his experience.
That's
he hasn't
it.
Been anywhere,
yeah.
man. Whereas the more experienced the lyrebird is, he goes through and gets different sounds. He hears, you know, like a creak here, babble, babble, he can imitate that.
Mm.
And as we saw on that David
Attenborough's favourite bird, yeah.
It can even mimic the sound of the electronic shutter.
Wasn't
that brilliant?
Down in Victoria.
Yeah.
Oh, that's his favourite bird, David Attenborough. He loves
But listen, there's more, right? So the male lyrebird goes through collecting the sounds of life to impress the female lyrebird. You know, he shows all his sounds, how experienced he is. Yeah, struts his stuff. She goes, he's been there.
Culturally diverse.
Yeah, yeah. Anyway, it's even more than that. So he's not just a mimic. But in the end, when they have their courtship ritual, the male lyrebird puts all the sounds that he's heard, plus his own sounds, and makes it like a symphony for her.
Wow.
Yes, and this bloke actually heard it, and they do it for a number of days or even...
Yep.
Weeks, and I came with him one down to try and record this thing, but
is that right?
Yeah, the lyrebird didn't turn up at the
must have heard.
Yeah, they can hear very well too. Yeah.
Oh, they're very smart birds, and you can stand on top if you're climbing down, say whether you be Lamington or down at Dorigo there near Coffs Harbour. If you're coming down through the rainforest from the top, especially if you're coming down from the top of the mountains down, there's nothing better than hearing a lyrebird, and you can hear a lyrebird from kilometres away. It echoes through the whole valley. And down at Fitzroy Falls, down in up from Shoalhaven there, down south between Sydney and Wollongong, but up in the mountains there, Fitzroy Falls, there's always lyrebirds around there. That's the Leleander, I think the species is called.
Oh, yeah.
And they're more common, obviously. Yeah. They're more temperate rather than subtropical, but they're magic birds, and they're absolutely beautiful birds.
Yeah, and we're in a beautiful, magical area. And now for some beautiful, revolutionary more music. This is Latin-based because I've left the recordings of Daddy Cool, or I think, I don't know, there's some mix-up today. We were trying to get Daddy Cool, who's...
The Dunner Runner.
Yeah, okay, so...
We on Tune MFM have...
Fearless, cheeky, challenging, informative, alternative, relevant news and analysis.
They have Alan Jones, advertisements, John Law, advertisements, recycled hit parade, and advertisement.
We on Toon FM have
local artists,
world music,
homegrown talent,
scathing songs that make progress musical,
and cutting-edge releases expanding the boundaries of experimentation and creative exaggeration.
They have Alan Jones, John Laws, Casper Comment, and oh,
advertisements.
Of course.
We have dedicated, hard-working volunteers, talented artists, original productions, and a band of loyal, local sponsors who we just love.
Yeah, how do you do? That's something woke together there. Right, well, it is now 1:35. We will be going through till 2 o'clock here on the web crawl, after which the Johnny Bales and the Nimbin Aboriginal broadcasters will be with you, taking you through to 5 o'clock.
Fantastic.
Yep. And speaking of all that stuff that we get in Nim FM, that other places that don't, now Warwick got this, it's got quite a long thing on toads, frogs and toads it's called. That goes 30 minutes, I don't know if we can squeeze it in, but he was very keen on putting it on, so maybe I
bring on the herpetology.
Okay, let's have a listen to what Warwick's come up with yet again.
You took your frog when you got your salamander, right? How long did it live?
Well, it lived for like a week and a couple of days because I don't really know much about them. So next time before I get one, I'm going to get more advice.
Okay. You didn't know how to take care of it.
Yeah, but I gave it all that Natasha told me what she said to do.
Okay. Was it too cold maybe? Or it was maybe hibernating and you got it out?
No, sure. I think it was too cold or it was too hot.
How about frogs and toads?
Well, yeah, I know a bit is that they're really much different because some of them, they have different types of feeling and one has bumps and the other one doesn't. And they both have different names and they like, they don't eat like different things, but all I know is they eat both flocks and they like much the water, but I don't really know.
Yeah, well, there we go. Ian, that's frogs over there. Sounds like an American that over there works. Come up with?
Yes.
And what about frogs here? Do you know anything about frogs here?
I do like my frogs. Yeah.
Hey, they are supposed to be sort of like a climate indicator, aren't they?
Yep, that's right.
If there are a lot of frogs around, it means your climate's good, isn't it?
Well, it'd be more rain-related if there's the right conditions. But there's areas even in the south of like Cornwall where there's, in England, where there's frog species we've never seen before, and then that's an indicator of the warming of southern England.
They're an indicator of the climate that you're in, eh?
Well, there's also negative implication to global warming as far as, especially with holes in ozone layers and whatnot, with increasing solar radiation.
Yeah.
Frogs with their porous skin, they're having troubles with increased solar radiation. I'm no expert on this. This is other people's information, obviously. But, and also bacteria, skin bacteria. Humans are, we're to blame for a lot of frog problems as far as handling frogs. I was at the pub one day.
They get infected from us?
Yeah, well, there was a girl from overseas and she picked up a frog, a Latoria, green tree frog, and I said, oh, look, you shouldn't really be handling them, blah, blah, blah. People don't understand that you can be cruel.
The green tree frog, yes.
Yeah.
For our Canadian listeners out there in podcast land, the green tree frog is a wonderful frog.
It's beautiful.
It's very big. It's about as big as your fist, and it has a green glossy skin. And it comes, look, I tell you what, it comes in when your place is overloaded with cockroaches. And it comes in and it eats them. I love my green. And then it eats them and then it leaves. And, it, you know, you can step on it and they survive too.
I've trod on one and down. There's as many as you get here, they triple it and down, like, especially in early morning. They go ballistic in at night and I love them. And you can tread on them and you can feel like treading on a rubber glove.
That's right. They look so fragile, but they're really, really tough.
Oh, they're cool here too, because you've got the rainforest and they come up on your back veranda and they're very cute. And you get little tiny ones in the trees too, and they're great as well.
Yeah. Now, how do we get onto that? You were talking about
Yeah,
that.
Well, just swimming in the water holes in some areas. You know, some areas now are closed off to, like, Protester Falls and Tunnable, simply because of frog research and all different species.
You're telling me Protester Falls closed off now?
Oh, it has been for a while now. You can't swim there now. You can walk up there.
Oh, right.
You can't swim because of sunburn cream.
The sunburn
30
cream.
30 plus, 15 plus, that's the oils.
Yeah.
No good for
frogs. Kills the frogs.
I don't know enough about that as far as it kills them, but I'm sure it does. And also, it just upsets breeding programs. You've got your frog spawn. Frog spawn doesn't need oil and poisons and again, human...
I can see how they can become a barometer of the environment.
Here's another interesting fact. They bought some frog for women's contraceptive, the pill. They used frog ovary hormones from African frog.
Who did?
Pharmaceutical companies, yes. It's a trigger that switches off hormones, I'm guessing.
Oh, right.
Stops pregnancy.
And they got
but
off
that,
frogs.
Yeah, well, that is, some, that bought, these frogs they bought in from Africa released a bacteria into the Australian wilderness too, which is killing off frog species. And places like the Daintree, which is the only place in the world which has a member from every family of plant species. It's listed as the oldest rainforest in the world, even though other areas are just as old.
What do you mean it's got every plant?
There's a member.
It doesn't have an English oak up there, does it?
No. It has a representative from every family member.
Oh, right. So the oak tree family. What family is the oak one in?
Quercus roba, Quercus. I couldn't tell you.
In a Quercus family.
Yeah, they're Quercus. That's the genus.
So there would be a Quercus representative.
No. That's the genus. So it's family.
Oh, yeah.
Say, for example, eucalyptus has Angophora eucalyptus, blah blah blah. That's Proteaceae. No, sorry, that's Myrtaceae.
I think we're just talking a few too many big words.
Yeah, okay,
here,
well, there's, you might have, say, for example, 20 families.
Yeah.
Represented around the world, and it's more than that, obviously, just an example, and a representative of each of those families will be found in the Daintree Rainforest, the other place that occurs. That's why it's World Heritage.
Oh.
And there's frogs up there that started disappearing in the last 10 years, just gone, vanished, and people scratching their heads going, where are they gone? What's happening, you know? And I'm sure it must be very, you know, the researchers who just love their frogs, salamanders, utes, all the rest of it.
Yeah.
We only have frogs and toads in this country. We don't have salamanders and utes. That'd be horrifying.
How do we do our magic spells then? That's what you need, isn't it? Eye of newt and leg of salamander or something.
And cane toad residue off the back of the neck and loosen it.
Oh, you could do some good spells with a cane. Wonder what happens if you boil them up.
That used to be a well-known remedy. People were boiling them up and dropping dead. Overdosing on LSD, pretty much.
What, out of the...
It's hallucinogenic. The compound in the glands behind the neck is hallucinogenic. So if you boil it up and drink the water, boiled water, it's like having magic mushrooms. But if you have too much of it, like anything, too much of a good thing's a bad thing.
Yeah, well, I know all the wildlife are dying from eating the cane toad, don't they?
Yeah.
So they'd go out with some kind of transcendental hallucinatory departure, would they? Is that what happened?
Honestly said, yeah.
Terrible way to die.
It wouldn't be much fun. I mean, it's poison. At the end of the day, you're poisoned. Yeah, yeah. You go green and you see green. And you've
Got what is happening with the cane toads? Do you have any...
I got one interesting fact.
I noticed there's more in Nimbin now. I never got them at my place much, but I've noticed them in the last month or so.
I only moved to Nimbin myself 6 months ago, but I've been a friend of Nimbin for quite a few years back and forth, and I lived in New South Wales, Northern New South Wales, blah, blah, blah. And I was here when they first started moving in, and people freaking out.
Yeah.
Now there's a lot more than there was when I was here a few years ago. Now, the problem is, this being a subtropical climate and just north of here being tropical, as they're moving down towards Port Macquarie in Sydney, they're going into more warm temperate climates, and they're actually their leg spans increasing, so they're becoming a larger animal.
Oh, no, we've got super cane toads.
We've got a hybrid. It's almost like a subspecies developing.
Yeah, the Australian cane toad.
And they're heading towards... And then you've got the Indonesian house gecko that's moving around with camper vans and all the rest of it, and they're all the way down now.
Moving around, mean in camper vans.
Oh, they're right around the world, they're on the equator as well.
They don't drive, do they?
Yeah, they will drive if you give them a leg up. But we've got our own native geckos, of course, but they don't hang around the walls like the Indonesian ones do as much. But the Bufano marinus, which is the cane toad.
Say that again. Let's try and be smart. Bufaranus.
Sorry. And what is it?
Bufano
is the genus, and marinus is the species. So the cane toad being marinus tells you one thing, marine.
Yeah.
Now, this species, how did it get across to Kakadu, for instance? What happened is they moved by night and they used cow dips or whatever you want to call the water, where they drink water from.
Not cow dips, surely.
Not dips, but with the fresh water. Not
puddles.
Dips, French onion, whatever. But the thing is, they also move across the Gulf Carpentaria. Now, there's some marine... whatever, your mangrove swamp or whatever, they'll actually handle a bit of salt water and they'll move across. So they've moved across into Kakadu also through marine habitats.
Gosh.
Frightening. I remember you coming up as a kid from Sydney to Brunswick Heads as a little kid and seeing all the toads around the rocks. And then I went to Fiji and they're everywhere.
Hey, look, I have heard there the wildlife has been adapting to them to some extent, and there are some natural predators now of the cane toad.
They can drop them and eat. The glands are on the behind the neck. So
yes,
the crow,
yes.
With crows and ravens, crows are highly intelligent.
I tell you, the crows are one of them. These are their natural predators now in Australia. The crows, they know about that. The ibis, the sacred ibis.
Is that right?
They know how to do it. They flip them with their... They've got a very tactile... What's the word? The beak is... with that...
Flexible. Not flexible.
Chopsticks, but they can do delicate things with them, and they flip them. They flip the cane toad over and eat them from the belly.
That's another problem in itself. I was doing studies on the ibis in Sydney at Centennial Park. My friend's now running the show there, and he's doing his master's degree on it. They're a native species. They're not from Egypt like a lot of people assume. They're definitely a native species.
Yeah.
We've got the glossy, and we've also got the straw neck. We've got three species of ibis in Australia. The sacred ibis, or the white ibis, is now in overpopulating much of the East Coast simply because they're very well adapted to human environments, and their other species aren't even getting a foot in to breed in a lot of areas now.
Yeah, and they probably have a nice big source of cane toads too.
That's one good thing. Didn't know that, and that's exciting in its own way.
Yeah. Right, well, there are a few others. I just might go through them. The humble bush rat knows how to eat a cane toad, apparently, and meat ants do as well. So, did I list five? I don't know. Anyway,
a friend of mine up Darwin, Tony Griffiths, he researches a lot of frilled lizards, frontic lizards. He's he said that the Varanidae, which is the goanna species, which the top end around Darwin region, there's more species of goanna there. There's a hot spot.
Yeah.
Goannas. And he said they'll come back. They'll survive. They'll adapt.
Yes, I have this feeling too. I think the Australian bush is much tougher than people give it credit for.
Yeah.
And like the first wave of cane toads has come through, but I think they will become in time part of the local landscape. There's nothing else they can do because they can't get rid of them now.
But that always happens with any species of any area. They'll lie low for a while and then boom, they just take off. And then eventually things slow down because they start becoming part of the environment. Now, whether that's going to happen with this camphor laurel, I was spun out the other day seeing scaly breasted and rainbow lorikeets eating camphor laurel. I didn't even click with me. I'm so busy seeing the pigeons eating it, native pigeon, rainforest pigeons. I didn't actually even think about the lorikeets doing that. They love it.
Yeah.
Bit of a worry.
Well, now here's another story regarding camphor laurel. This was told to me.
Which is a Chinese tree, by the way. Asian tree. Yeah.
Well, actually, I heard this story. It's like with the cane toad. We have our own camphor laurel, which is a
native rainforest laurels. Yeah.
Well, we do, but I mean, the camphor laurel we have, the story I heard, is a cross between the Chinese and the Japanese camphor laurels.
Is that right? I didn't know Japan had them.
No, well, neither did I.
Well, that's the same with our Salix, our weeping willows from Japan and China. They're cross-hybridized in Australia now, and they're forming their own species of down in the cooler areas between Melbourne and, say, Sydney on the rivers,
And the type we're evolving is a much sort of a more robust...
Australian-ready.
Yeah. And, well, look, as far as camphor laurels go, I just cannot believe that they're a weed. And
they're beautiful. And they are. Rainforest is popping up under them. It's just a matter of controlling
that's right.
it. There's areas where there was no trees, now there's camphor laurel, and then there's got rainforest coming
up. Yes, and that's one of the reasons They're there. Nature's shocked troops. You can't ringbark a camphor laurel, and when you go around ringbarking a forest, what it means is you're gonna get camphor laurels coming back because they can. You can't ringbark them.
They shoot off the roots. They shoot little
any little bit coming, and even if you get them, pull the whole roots out. They got viable seeds too. So they're another one. But the interesting thing is. When you're in here, you think they're going to take over the world, but they don't. I was surprised to learn that they don't predominate up north.
I heard that last week.
Yes, in tropical regions, so they're sort of like an indicator of a sub.
But even the Sunshine Coast doesn't have many.
Yeah, so they're sort of like an indicator of our own special region around here.
Yeah, and Sydney. They're
big down
huge
there.
Huge in Sydney. Loads of camphor around the Sydney region.
Mm.
Similar climate to here, not quite as warm, but, almost subtropical Sydney. Mm.
But I can remember coming, because I originally came from Adelaide, and then I was in Melbourne for a long time, and when I moved to this area, I came up by car, pulling my trailer full of, like the clamp, it was a bit, all this alternative looming stuff. And then we went through all thousands and thousands of miles of the blue-green eucalyptus forest, of course. And then
eucalyptus saligna is the white gum, was that one?
Desert area,
I think along the east coast.
Well, we did, but we took, how did we go? We came via the Hume Highway.
Okay.
So, yes. Anyway, the point being that eucalyptus have a particular kind of greenery, a grey-green greenery, which is predominant all the way down south. But as soon as you get up here into the North Coast region around Nimbin, these wonderful trees, these vivid, robust, shady trees, these camphor laurels are there. And I was saying, to some of the locals, what are those lovely trees over there? And they go, they're camphor laurels. Well, they're a weed,
I like crushing the leaf. And when I'm working in the rainforest and it's under the canopy and it's dark, and you're not quite sure what's in front of you sometimes, you just grab the leaf and smell, and it's camphor. And it's like, it's got to go, but a geel's a nice little gift for a minute there. If you burn ping pong balls and they make smoke bombs with foil out of ping pong balls, and it's the same thing, it smells like camphor laurel.
Really? Yeah. I know they make...
Important information.
Yeah. Well, naphthalene. But I know the Chinese, in particular, make the wardrobes out of camphor laurel because of that very same thing. They're insect-reducing properties. Moths don't like camphor laurels.
Well, we're looking out the window right now at a heritage species, which is a camphor laurel. Certain trees, by law, you can't remove because they're huge.
Which one is it?
Wait a minute.
Okay. This is Action Live Radio. Ian... That's the other Ian, not me, is going...
It's up there.
All right. Yes. Yeah. Well, look, how about that?
10 metres up to the right. You can't quite see it.
No. All this time that I've been coming to the radio station, I didn't realise there's a heritage tree I've been walking under. So it's interesting, like, people point out things to you, and your brain expands to a greater universe. Yes, okay. Well, now we have been talking a little bit, and it is approaching the hour of 2 o'clock where we must depart from the scene. I'm going to put on some more revolutionary music and
stay tuned because there's some great music coming up. JD plays some wicked music.
Oh yes, okay, and very suitable, like with that beat and didge. The didge seems to work so well at festivals. Rhythm of life in it, I think. All right, well. Have I played this one? Let's have a listen. This is another Latin one.
See ya. Thank you.